The time is now. Volume 2, Episode 26. I am still Mike Schmidt, and I am still the host of this podcast, Employment Law Now. Thank you so much for joining us again. I hope you are well underway toward having a really great 2018. There is so much to talk about, and I'm going to continue that today, starting with our Trending Now segment. Eagles or Patriots? Eagles or Patriots? I really don't care that much. My team ended its year early once again. Many people do care, however, for various reasons. There is, of course, the football game itself next week and the rooting interests that exist. There are also some who are waiting to see how the financial markets do this year based on the reported historical trends that have occurred, depending on whether the Super Bowl is won by the NFC team or the AFC team. From my perspective, there are also some employment law points to be made. So, before I officially move on emotionally to the next sports season, it's worth finishing this NFL season with a thought on the world's most popular one-day sporting event, that is the Super Bowl. Fans of their New England and Pennsylvania teams obviously have tremendous interest in this coming weekend's game, but historical ratings show that the rest of the world cares as well for financial reasons. Much time will be spent this coming week in person as well as online trying to make money on the Super Bowl, right? And that's the hook for today's Trending Now segment. Online technology and social media in particular have made it much easier for employees to participate in all things Super Bowl and to sit in the office and participate with those outside the four walls of the office. If you haven't been asked to join a Super Bowl pool just yet, it's more than likely that it's not because you have no friends at work. It'll get to you, more than likely. But the question is, are Super Bowl pools actually legal? I get this question all the time. And is there any impact of social media here? Well, many states exempt social gambling from their anti-gambling statutes. Social gambling, while it may be defined differently depending on your jurisdiction, social gambling is generally defined as playing for money in a purely social context where no player or other person, such as a host, can make anything more or anything different than from simply being a player like any other player. So as long as the entire pool is distributed with nothing taken off the top, it is generally okay in many states. So generally, you're not going to have a real issue with social gambling like these football pools, like these Super Bowl pools are in your office. Nevertheless, I think the issue of office Super Bowl pools and social media in general raise a few noteworthy points that I think are worth mentioning. First, the loss of productivity and loss of time. Certainly, Super Bowl blogging and posting and surfing the net for all things Super Bowl will take a lot of time. Time at work and time during working hours for your employees when they're presumably supposed to be working for your company. That's one issue that we're going to see a lot about this coming week. Issue two, can Bobby come out to play? You know, office Super Bowl pools should be open to everyone and shouldn't be a means for violating other workplace policies that you have, such as by harassing or discriminating against people who choose not to join or who are not asked to join. And then lastly, does social really equal social? Permissible social gambling generally requires some social relationship here, meaning that the promotion of your office pool to those outside the company through social media may lead to becoming a pool that includes those with whom there is no bona fide social relationship. So keep that in mind if you're one of those who is creating and administrating your Super Bowl pool. keep in mind that there really needs to be some social aspect to this. So what is the takeaway here? There probably are bigger pictures that your company should consider when it comes to important issues and policies involving gambling and the impact that social media has had on workplace gambling. For this week, however, the reality is that this may just be another example of some lawyer turned Super Bowl Scrooge, as it really is unlikely that the cast of Law & Order will be coming into your establishment merely as a result of this Sunday's game. So perhaps you can just relax a little and allow for the morale of your employees to improve with the excitement and buildup of the year's biggest one-day event. There are only 5 working days left until the big sports buzz is over, after all. That is, of course, until pitchers and catchers report in 3 weeks. Yay. So we continue with the Trending Now segment, and I also want to talk about the uptick in religious and national origin discrimination, particularly focused on an interesting case out of Georgia. For those of you who are keeping score at home, the name of the case is Cole versus Cobb County School District out of the Northern District of Georgia. And it's an interesting attempt, I think, to increase the scope of religious discrimination claims under Title VII. Disability claims, as many of you know, particularly under the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, they have what's known as a regarded as claim, a perceived as claim, so that even if an individual doesn't actually have a disability, if an employer regards that individual as disabled, perceives that individual as disabled, and acts based on that perception, there could be a claim under the disability laws. Here, the plaintiff is an elementary school assistant principal who was very big on yoga-based mindfulness lessons that she wanted to promote to her students. Of course, parents complained about it, saying that, well, among other things, she was trying to indoctrinate students to Buddhism. The problem was that the assistant principal is not practicing Buddhism, but is actually a practicing Christian. Nevertheless, after the parents complained about these new lessons, the principal was reassigned to another school and, of course, sued the school district and the county. The principal alleged that the school district perceived her to be part of a certain religion, here Buddhism, and then discriminated against her because of that religion. Well, interestingly, the court dismissed the complaint, finding that religious discrimination claims under Title VII, which is what this case was brought under, do not include a perceived as or regarded as permissible theory. In other words, for religious discrimination claims, a plaintiff must be in fact part of the protected class when you're talking about Title VII. Title VII, in other words, does not protect individuals who are perceived to be holding a religious belief when the defendant is wrong, unlike the ADA and disability claims. So because this particular individual was not in this protected class, part of this Buddhism religion, there is no perceived as, there is no regarded as claim, therefore there was no Title VII theory that could be had. But some interesting takeaways here, and again this is where it goes to what I believe is the trend and the uptick in religious and national origin discrimination. I've said this before, I think really following the most recent presidential election, and because of a lot of the rhetoric and a lot of what's going on in 2017 and up until this new year in 2018, a lot of people are bringing their political views into the workplace. A lot of people are talking about things and saying things that really implicate religious rights and national origin rights. So what you're seeing, I believe, is an uptick in the number of claims, both internal complaints as well as externally to agencies like the EEOC and in court, claiming that people are being harassed or discriminated against. So it's real important for your company to make sure that you understand that these claims are increasing. Make sure that your trainings and your policies really promote diversity and inclusion and religious sensitivities along with the other protected classes that you are focusing on when it comes to your trainings and policies. And the other takeaway is that this Cole case is just another example of what I think is going to continue to happen. plaintiffs and their attorneys, employees and their attorneys, trying to be creative in broadening and expanding existing law when it comes to harassment and discrimination. So keep that in mind as we move forward in 2018. We move to the DC Now segment. And I want to talk about something very briefly that I've touched on in a couple of prior episodes, and that is the criminal aspect of restrictive covenants, particularly here when we're talking about no poaching agreements, where we're not talking about an agreement entered into by an employer and an employee. We're talking about agreements entered into between two or more employers that limit the rights of each of the other employers to the agreement to poach each other's employees. No poaching agreements. And again, I talked about this in prior episodes, and the issue here really came up when there was this new antitrust guidance that was issued by the Department of Justice back in October of 2016. So what's the important development here? What's the update from DC now? I think what's important here is that what we have been hearing and seeing a lot about recently at the beginning of 2018 is that the aggressive approach that the Obama administration and the Obama agencies took and that seemed to be dialed back now, seemed to be scaled back with this new Republican-led administration in Washington, the aggressive approach does not seem to be changing with this new administration in Washington when it comes to this restrictive covenant, this no poaching agreement issue. So just a couple of weeks ago, here in January of 2018, the Justice Department confirmed that it has been and will continue to be very active in prosecuting criminally agreements between companies to not poach each other's employees, deeming it to be violations of antitrust laws. And at a recent conference in Virginia, a Department of Justice speaker actually said, quote, "In the coming months, you will see some announcements," end quote. What we expect there is that we're going to hear about some companies, particularly perhaps some high-profile companies, being charged not only civilly, but perhaps with some criminal sanctions for entering into and trying to enforce these no poaching agreements. So it's important, whether it's pre-litigation or part of a litigation settlement, that you and your company understand the potential ramifications when it comes to how these no poaching agreements are being viewed, not just from the employment side of things, but also as a potential antitrust issue and as a potential criminal problem. We move now to our Noteworthy Now segment. And for this, I want to talk a little bit more about the recent tax reform and its implications on sexual harassment cases. I got all kinds of questions, and there have been all kinds of discussions I've been involved in since our last episode when I mentioned this issue briefly, so I thought it was worth digging a little bit deeper on this and giving you some expanded thoughts on sexual harassment cases and the recent tax reform out of Washington. We all know that at the end of last year, President Trump signed significant tax reform into law, and that tax reform, as hopefully you know by now, included what many have referred to as the Harvey Weinstein provision. This provision uses the tax code and tax-based incentives, or you might say disincentives, to try to change workplace behavior, particularly out of this whole Me Too sexual harassment movement. So now we have a new section in the tax code. It's actually section 162Q of the code, which prohibits any deductions, any tax deductions being taken for sexual harassment or sexual abuse settlement payments, including attorney's fees, if the settlement or if the payment is subject to a confidentiality agreement, some non-disclosure provision. This is not something that is going to take a while to become effective. It was actually effective on enactment, and it applies to any payments made after December 22nd, 2017. So we are right square in the middle of this. The new tax provision here, this new section 162Q, does not require employers to do anything. However, it does give employers a choice. You can either deduct the cost of the settlement payment as an ordinary business expense deduction, as presumably you have in the past if you had that kind of settlement, without a confidentiality provision being as part of the settlement, or you can now include the confidentiality or non-disclosure provision, but not take the deduction. Presumably, the choice will depend on the actual amount of the settlement at issue and the amount of the potential deduction when you're balancing that with your company's interest or concern about maintaining confidentiality for a particular case. But as easy as that rule, as that provision seems to be on its face, it's really leading to a whole lot of questions that I think are real important for your company to consider with or without outside counsel. We don't have much guidance, if any, on any of these questions, certainly no judicial decisions because it's that early, but I think it's worth noting a few questions that you should be thinking about on this issue of sexual harassment, sexual abuse settlements, and confidentiality provisions, and the ability to take tax deductions here. First question, does sex discrimination fall within the term sexual harassment? Again, the terms sexual harassment and sexual abuse and even the term non-disclosure are just not defined in this new tax code. So we have to determine, I think, as we move forward, how are we defining these terms? Is it literally just involving claims of sexual harassment as opposed to sex discrimination? Does a general release, as you often find in your settlement agreements, that cover all possible claims, asserted and unasserted, known and unknown, does that general release trigger this new tax deduction rule, even in cases that don't actually have sexual harassment claims being asserted? Again, you have a case where there are no sexual harassment claims, but you have a full general release that covers all kinds of claims. I.e., all claims would include sexual harassment claims as well. So does just having a general release in that situation trigger this new tax code provision? Again, the rule doesn't offer guidance to determine what payment is related to sexual harassment or sexual abuse cases. A very broad approach might suggest that a general release and a payment as consideration for that general release is payment that is, quote, related to, end quote, sexual harassment or sexual abuse. And should parties expressly allocate their payments now by the certain claims that are being released? So let's say you even have a case where sexual harassment claims have been litigated in addition to others. Should you, as a company, start allocating in your settlement agreement X number of dollars that are being paid for the sexual harassment claims, X number of dollars being allocated for, say, the age discrimination or the retaliation claim? Is that something that you should be thinking about as part of your settlement agreement? In a related question, what about regular separation agreements that don't come about after claims have actually been made? You're hearing all of this in the context of settlement agreements when there have been sexual harassment or sexual abuse claims asserted. What about when you are terminating an employee or an employee is leaving and you're entering into a run-of-the-mill severance agreement? Well, that severance agreement tends to have releases in them. Even if a sexual harassment or a sexual abuse claim has not been asserted and you have that general release in there, what if you also have a confidentiality provision? Is this going to trigger the tax deduction provision that has just been enacted as part of the tax reform? What are plaintiffs and their attorneys going to do? Are plaintiffs going to try to negotiate higher settlement payments in sexual harassment claims for the perceived value of having confidentiality provisions? I've already started to hear whispers about that and see that come into play a little bit. Will plaintiffs actually request language expressly stating that no sexual harassment allegations were ever made? What if they want to take it a step further and suggest language in the settlement agreement which says that nothing in this settlement agreement pertains to sexual harassment claims? Well, the employees, the plaintiffs, and their attorneys have an interest here too, because, and it may have been an unintended consequence that gets fixed with a subsequent amendment, but right now, arguably, this no tax deduction rule seemingly applies not just to the businesses, not just to the employers, but also to the individuals who are getting payments. So will plaintiffs' attorneys try to have language which expressly state that no sexual harassment allegations were ever made? What do you as a business do when you're trying to have the certainty and the finality of the full general release on the one hand, but on the other hand, language being proposed that the release and the agreement don't deal with sexual harassment claims? I guess one benefit of that is that you don't trigger this new tax deduction rule, but on the other hand, is that leaving the door open for subsequent claims of sexual harassment if you are agreeing expressly that this settlement agreement and this general release does not cover sexual harassment claims? And what about this effective date? What about this December 22nd, 2017 effective date? What about settlement agreements that were entered into before the effective date, but that have continuing stream of payments that are extending after December 22nd, 2017? So you settled a case last Thanksgiving, the end of November 2017, but your settlement payments are being made in installments. You know, one every 2 weeks with the regular payroll, or one every month for the next 10 months. So the agreement was made before the December 22nd effective date, but the payments, pursuant to an agreement that may have a confidentiality provision, are continuing after the December 22nd date. What about that situation? Does that trigger this new tax code provision? Well, a lot of you are sitting in your car and maybe in your kitchen, maybe at your desk, maybe on the train, maybe on your bicycle, I don't know, thinking to yourself, well, Mike, are you going to answer any or all of these questions? And to me, as I say all the time, the important aspect of employment law, and frankly my view of the important aspect of talking about the law generally, is not necessarily to find out what the answers are. It's to identify what the questions are. That, to me, is always the most critical aspect of employment law and the law generally. And the real answer to that is, you know, these questions have not been answered yet. We just don't know. It's too early since this new tax reform has been passed. We don't have any guidance. We don't have any judicial opinions giving us answers. But what I think was important is to dive a little bit more deeply into this issue, not just take at face value what the provision says, which, again, seems to be fairly simple and non-complicated on its face, and realize that we've got all of these questions out there that you and your companies should be thinking about and exploring when you are deciding to enter into a settlement agreement for a particular case, and who knows, maybe even a severance agreement that doesn't arise from the settlement of a lawsuit. So your takeaways here on this noteworthy issue: do a review, with or without counsel, certainly of the settlement agreements and the severance agreements that you are going to enter into now as we're post-December 22nd, but also think about looking back at the ramifications if you and your company have any settlement agreements that were entered into before December 22nd, but contemplate payments that are continuing now. And the other takeaway in the end, let's not forget about the underlying issue. The underlying issue that we're talking about, and that is sexual harassment and sexual abuse. That there is still a need, remarkably to me, but there still is a need in 2018 to examine your company's sexual harassment policies, your company's reporting procedures, and the trainings that your company gives to its employees, in particular those managers and supervisors who are in the trenches day to day with the rank and file employees. It is mind-boggling to me that in 2018 we still have to be focused on and talk about sexual harassment issues and preventing sexual harassment and sexual abuse in the workplace. It's mind-boggling that these things are still going on. But as I also say all the time, you can't ignore reality. And the realities of 2018 certainly include that we need to focus as a business community and as a legal community on these issues. So I hope This information today was informative and will be useful, and it's something that you can take back to your companies in the days and weeks going forward. I look forward to continuing the effort to try to educate and entertain where I can. Please do not hesitate, as so many have in the past year since we've been doing this podcast. Please don't hesitate to email me, call me with ideas, things that you'd like to hear about in this podcast and upcoming episodes, people that you'd love to hear me interview as a guest, issues that you'd love to get me to have guests on, good, bad, indifferent, any kind of comments you have, I welcome all of them. I really, at the end of the day, appreciate you listening. So until the next time, I hope all of your labor is productive.